In the past 2 years, there have been many, many events in the church, and it's been a tumultuous time. But there's also been many, many tumultuous events and fast pace of change in the secular world as well. What have been some of these rapid developments in civil society?
Well, in recent times, outstandingly, surely the change, quote-unquote, in the communist East European countries with the falling of the Berlin Wall, and then since then, the invasion of Iraq or the occupation of Saudi Arabia, the entry into Saudi Arabia by a very large American expeditionary force. I think these are probably the two most outstanding events.
Yes, and I think, of course, the biggest one is the changes that are happening in the communist countries. What do you think is going on, actually, in the communist countries?
Well, how one reads these events in the communist countries depends upon how one reads communism. If one goes back to a Catholic view of communism, such as Pius XI expressed in his encyclical on communism in 1937, Divina Redemptoris, I think it is, there's a paragraph, there's a whole long paragraph in which Pius XI expressly warns people that communism is capable of changing its outward appearance or changing its form in order to continue pursuing exactly the same goal. It's very deceptive.
What is that goal?
World domination.
And is also being in opposition to the church another one of its goals?
Well, yes, they wish to destroy the Catholic Church. Communism seeks to destroy the Catholic Church, to extirpate the last remains of this false bourgeois religion. That's their kind of language. And communism is unquestionably designed by Satan to help to destroy the Catholic Church. There's no doubt about that. But whether or not all communists are aware in their own minds that they are destroying the Catholic Church, they are all aware in their own minds that they have to help make the revolution, as they call it, triumph all over the world. And so world domination is present in all of their minds, even if the destruction of the Catholic Church is not present in all of their minds.
Now, what are some of the characteristics of the changes going on in the communist countries at present?
Well, a lot of the restrictions seem to have fallen away, partly under pressure, for instance, travel restrictions, some financial restrictions. It's much easier for the West. The Western businessmen can now go in and out of communist countries easily in order to make money and to sell wonderful things like, of course, Playboy magazine behind what used to be the Iron Curtain. Generally, these changes have most likely been brought about by an economic collapse inside these countries. I mean, communism just doesn't work from the economic point of view. It, like socialism, it violates human nature. It goes against human nature, and therefore, it just doesn't work. Since it doesn't work economically, all of these poor countries that have been under communism for 30, 40 years since the Second World War are now bankrupt and in all kinds of economic difficulties. And this is one of the things that has pressurized the communist authorities to let the barriers down and to let the West in, or let Westerners in, and to allow for a measure of economic change and hopefully, as they hope, a little more economic prosperity. Whether things are really deep down changed or not is another question. Somebody wisely said to me the other day, you know, if you want to know whether there's been a real revolution, look who's got the guns. If it's different people that have got the guns now from those that had the guns before the so-called revolution, then you've got a genuine revolution. But if it's exactly the same people that still have the guns, then the so-called revolution is just deceit. And there's no.
Then it's more of a metamorphosis than a revolution.
Yeah, There's no question that inside these Eastern European communist countries, exactly the same people have the guns. The communists still control the army, they still control the police force. Inside Eastern Germany, there's still sitting, as far as I know, an army of 350,000 Russian soldiers, which were there, who were there before the coming down of the Berlin Wall, and who are still there now. And the effect of the coming down of the Berlin Wall, a German was telling me a few weeks ago that, you know, Russians are now moving around inside Western Germany without anybody to stop them. And it's logical. If East and West Germany are now united, and the Russians are entitled to occupy East Germany, well, then to sit in East Germany, then they're perfectly entitled to sit inside Western Germany. And I compare the events in Eastern Europe a little to a lock on a river. You may remember that when the lock in the water is high, the upper gate you can easily open and shut, but the lower gate is totally closed by the pressure of the water. If, on the other hand, you let the water out of the lock, then the upper gate is completely shut, but the lower gate you can open freely. And the lower reach of the river is like communism. The upper reach of the river is what the West used to be. Inside the lock is, but the West is like inside the lock. The upper reach of the river is the spiritual way of life. Now, when the West was spiritual, the upper gate was freely open, but the lock gate against communism was absolutely jammed. But when the West closed the gate against the spiritual, the upper gate against the spiritual way of life, and allowed its level to drop, then opening the gate between the West and the communism is nothing, and I think that's what's happened. The West, in other words, the West by 1989, the West had grown so decadent that the communists knew that if they let down the Berlin Wall, the Westerners would not really change much in Eastern Europe against communism, because in fact, the West is mostly communist already. So I think the coming down of the Berlin Wall represented the opening of the lower lock gate, so that the water inside the corrupt Western lock and inside the lower communist reach of the river just freely flows in and out, but the lock gate is shut against God. The upper lock gate is shut, both in West and in the communist countries, against God. And therefore, you know, there's no real loss or defeat. There's no real loss to communism. There's no real defeat of communism. There's no real change of communism. It's still exactly the same godless system, going through, as you say, a kind of metamorphosis in order to deceive a number of foolish Westerners. But it's simply the godless East joining the godless West, which leaves us in exactly the same, if not even worse, situation than before. I was talking to a colleague of mine in the society, a priest who was inside Czechoslovakia a few months ago, and he said the position from the point of view of religion is very, very bad. And the people have suffered from years and years of militant atheism, and they're drinking in the corruption of the West, which is now available to them like Playboy magazine and so on. And there's not really, there's no indication at all of any serious spiritual revival or of any upgrading of real values inside these countries since the contact with, the re-established contact with the corrupt and decadent West. So, you know, in before God and in the eyes of God, I don't think these changes represent very much.
Some of my contacts in Eastern Europe say that in many ways, some things are getting worse. For example, drug use and pornography are spreading very rapidly in countries like Czechoslovakia and East Germany, and even Russia to a certain extent. It seems to a certain extent that the decadence of the West is rushing in.
Yes, this is what I hear too. I heard, you know, the Western businessmen being like in a feeding frenzy as they go into these Eastern countries which are opening up to them in order to establish markets and make a lot more money. You know, the West has very little to offer today except materialism and the pursuit of money and pleasure and so on. And So the West has very little with which to help or lift their oppressed brethren within the East.
From a spiritual point of view.
From a spiritual point of view is correct. And
that would have been different, let's say, if the gates had gone down 30-40 years ago.
For sure. That's why the gates went up, in order to keep out the West, which was stopping the communists from corrupting their people. But now that the Westerners are just as corrupt in their own way, the communists no longer have anything to fear from contact with the West, at any rate for the moment. And so they're allowing this free contact in and out, but the communists remain just as much in control of those communist countries as before. It's not been a real popular revolt. Even in Romania, which looked like the popular revolt, we now know that in fact it's one communist gang which replaced the previous communist gang.
And in one way, things got even worse because abortion was legalized after Ceausescu was overthrown.
And the new head in Romania is a personal friend of Gorbachev. So, and the revolution was green-lighted by Gorbachev. And likewise in Berlin, the coming down of the Berlin Wall was unquestionably green-lighted from Moscow before it took place. And so the communists are firmly in control of everything that's happening, and they know what they're doing, and it's the West that's being deceived, especially by the vile Western media, though I'm afraid there's no other adjective for them.
Could it be that the liberal ideology now is triumphing throughout the world and including in the communist countries, that liberalism, in a sense, has won?
Well, that's what some of the Western media say. I mean, the Western media, even somebody like Patrick Buchanan, who normally has his head screwed on, I think even he is writing things like, you know, we won the Cold War and the Cold War is now over. I mean, I don't believe it for one moment. Looking at things from a spiritual point of view, I don't believe it for one moment. I think that the communists are just as militant and as bent upon world domination as ever. And we're seeing the realization of that famous quotation of Dmitry Manuilsky going back to 1931, when he said, this Russian communist said, we're going to fight the West to the death. We're not strong enough to fight them now, but in a few years' time we will put them to sleep, and then we will bewitch them with an electrifying series of peace offers and concessions, and then when their guard is down we will smash them with our clenched fist.
Perhaps, though, for the time being, communism is taking a more liberal form.
Apparently, according to the appearances, yes. And these appearances are deceiving the liberals in the West, who don't see very deep and who never see things from a spiritual point of view, because liberals are very unspiritual men. As St. Paul says, they're animal men rather than spiritual men, and the animal man cannot understand the spiritual man, whereas the spiritual man sees everything and understands what's really happening. The liberals are deceived by this pro-liberalism on the part of communism, but of course the liberals are in fact deep down materialists, just like the communists, and that's why the liberals over the last 40-50 years have regularly helped and promoted communism, because they are deep down in synchro with communism, in synchronization with communism.
It's just that the materialism has taken a different form in the West than in the East, let's say, in the last 30-40 years.
Yes. In the West, it's been free enterprise materialism. In the East, it's been state materialism, state control materialism. And now the free enterprise materialists are cock-a-hoop, whooping with joy at the demonstration that their free enterprise materialism is more successful as materialism than the state-controlled materialism. But it's still all, from a spiritual point of view, it's still all materialism.
Which type of materialism do you think is more deadly to the Church? The liberal form of materialism or the communist form of materialism?
Well, that's an interesting question. One ought to say, well, of course, the West is more favorable to the Church than the communist countries, but one might even argue that the out-and-out opposition of the communists is such as it's been practiced inside the communist countries for the last 40 years, is 40, 50, 60, 70 years, one might argue that that actually does more good for the faith, not, of course, intentionally, but because it rouses more of a reaction.
Whereas,
than the liberals, the liberal countries, which rot the faith and which rot the church.
It's a very subtle kind of opposition.
Somebody said to me, he said, whereas the Russians have told us right from where they told us at the beginning of their revolution exactly what they were going to do to us, and it was a masculine and clear and straightforward opposition. The West is feminine and disguises itself and soft and weak, but just as corrupting, if not even more so, in its opposition.
Do you think that this could be part of the reason why then these changes have occurred? It's because the enemies of Christ have determined that the Western form of materialism, which is liberalism, is deadlier to Christianity than the communist form.
That might be part of their calculation. I think my guess is that the world government, I mean these evil powers that control the world today, that control both East and West, and that operate both East and West deep down in synchronization in order to bring about the one world government and the arrival of the Antichrist. These powers saw, on the one hand, that the Eastern economies were not in good shape. They saw, on the other hand, that the West was spiritually in such poor shape that there's no longer any danger of exposing the East to the West. And so they've dropped the barriers and of allowing the Westerners to bring in all their money and know-how and technique in order better to control the Eastern population, and in order, it may well also be, yes, the better to corrupt the Eastern population, because what does the local Russian secret police have failed to do, maybe Playboy will do. Yes, that's perfectly true. It's a possibility, I guess, in their calculations.
Now let's digress for a while to gain a better understanding of liberalism. Just what is liberalism?
Liberalism is a sort of philosophy and a way of life which has arisen, which has been given that name in the last 200 years especially, whereby man shall above all be free. He will be free to think what he likes, whether it's true or not, and he will be free to choose and to do what he likes, whether it's right or wrong. In other words, a freedom which is a complete license to do exactly as man likes.
Is it also freedom from God's laws?
Yes, if I'm free to do as I like, I liberate myself from any laws which I don't like. I mean, law will be what I consent to its being. If I like a certain set of laws, and if I say those laws are all right, then I submit to them, but they're only laws because I submit to them. And if the moment I choose no longer to submit to them, then they're no longer laws. That's liberalism, yes.
Let's take a look at some of the characteristics of liberalism. It would seem that one of its characteristics, then, is that it's man-centered rather than God-centered, if it means that men can just do whatever they like.
Yes, it's the great me. It's the refusal of any control, even of my mind, from outside. I mean, the ultimate of liberalism is to look outside the window, and if I see one tree, to say, well, I see three, because I'm not under the control of what my eyes see. My eyes may see that, but I say that there are three trees, and so there are three trees out there. I mean, it's the refusal of the truth. It's the refusal of any control from outside and independent of me, which I don't like. And obviously that puts me in the center of picture. I am the control, and I am the measure, and I am the king of everything around me and of the whole world, and so, yes, it's me in the place of God.
Is another characteristic that liberalism is constantly changing, whereas Catholicism is more fixed?
Yes, and it follows from the same principles, because human beings chop and change all the time, and so if I am the king and the of all creation and the measure of all truth, then if I say that this is truth today and I say something different is truth tomorrow, then the truth evolves, because men evolve. Whereas the Catholic Church says that truth depends upon God, the Catholic Church knows, it doesn't just say, it knows that God is unchanging, and it follows then that truth is unchanging. God's truth is unchanging. So the Catholic version is the truth is unchanging, but the liberal view is the truth depends on man, and so man changes, and therefore truth is changing.
Which means that it's very difficult to grasp hold of a liberal because he's constantly changing his colors.
Liberals are liable to be very slippery creatures because, yes, they believe and uphold what suits them, and it's liable to be different from one moment to the next, and you can't pin them down. Unless they allow themselves to be pinned down. But if they don't want to be pinned down, then according to their system, they just make another change or make another slip, and they're away. You can't pin them down.
Is liberalism also prevalent within the church?
Very much so. Liberalism has been trying to get inside the church for the last 200 years and more. And the history of the church, of the Catholic Church over the last 200 years can be seen in a way as the fight against of the Catholics against the liberals. And broadly speaking, the Catholics succeeded in keeping the liberals out of the church, broadly speaking, until Vatican II. There was infiltration, but the key positions were occupied by Catholics, and the liberals always had a hard time until Vatican II. Then the liberals were given the chance to flood into the church, and they took over all the power, positions of control and power. And now it's the Catholics who are in difficulties, and the Catholics who are oppressed, and the Catholics who are the minority. So prior to Vatican II and post-Vatican II, it's exactly the same pitch battle between liberals and Catholics that's going on. Those who put man in the center, those who put God in the center, those who say that God lays down the truth and those who say that man lays down the truth, those who say that God determines law and those who say that man determines law. That pitch battle has been going on both prior to Vatican II and since Vatican II. The only difference is that prior to Vatican II, the Catholics were dominant inside the Catholic Church. And now, since Vatican II, the liberals have been dominant inside the Vatican, inside the Catholic Church.
Since the liberals have been dominant inside the Catholic Church, have we obtained a church then that's constantly changing?
Yes, in accordance with their principles, and quite logically, their positions, their mass, their doctrine, their liturgy, their everything is liable to change every three years or every 3 months, every 3 weeks, if they care to make a change that often. And that's consistent with their principles.
Well, the theology of those on the left is changing along with the changes in Eastern Europe now. For example, a lot of the same people that used to push liberation theology are now kind of pushing an ecology theology. So their form has changed. But is there any consistency there?
Well, the consistency of a liberal is the consistency of inconsistency. Let's say the consistency of change. If a liberal keeps changing, he's being consistent with his liberalism. And that is the liberal's consistency. As for ecology and environmentalism, apparently there's a French politician, Le Pen, who came on TV a little while ago with a great big watermelon, and he cut in front of the cameras. The question came up: What are the environmentalists like? And he took a knife and he cut the watermelon right open, and he said, "The environmentalists are like this watermelon. It's all green on the outside, but red on the inside." In other words, the environmentalism and the ecologists and so on, that's another form of liberalism or communism. They're in synchronization with communism. And they are, in fact, atheistic, mostly. They worship nature. They glorify nature. They say that they're wanting to protect nature. But they hate the capitalists. They hate the Western way of life. They hate... They don't believe in God, for the most part, and they say they don't practice any religion, as far as I know, and their principles are completely in synchronization with the New World Order, with the New Age, with communism, with socialism. They're part of the same scene, in fact. So for a liberal to become an environmentalist or for an environmentalist to be a liberal is completely consistent.
So this environmental or ecology theology is closely actually related to the liberation theology, which was Marxism with a Christian veneer. Now it's kind of this ecology, actually in some cases a pagan theology surrounded again, with a Christian veneer. And you can see this coming out very plainly with somebody like Father Matthew Fox, who promotes this worship of Mother Earth.
Yeah, it's green on the outside and red on the inside. It's the same. Satan takes a thousand forms to attack the Catholic Church and Catholic truth. The Catholic truth remains always steady and the same. The Church is one, Satan is many. My name is Legion, for we are many, says the devil in the Gospels. And the devils are many, and they're constantly changing their doctrine, they're constantly changing their position, and that's characteristic of them, whereas the Catholic Church has unity and steadiness.
And is this steadiness exemplified in tradition?
Absolutely. The great joy of being a Catholic at any point in history is that you immediately find yourself plugging into great minds thinking exactly the same all the way down the centuries. You find yourself a kindred spirit with the best and truest and noblest minds and hearts and souls, the saints. It doesn't have to be that you read books, but you're in tune with all the great men and the truly great men and truly great women of all the ages.
And is this the focus of Archbishop Lefebvre's apostolate?
Exactly. He is preserving that line which was saved down the 19th century by the great anti-liberals fighting off the liberals, and the positions they took and the position that Archbishop Lefebvre takes are exactly the same. He's simply defending that same rock-solid position, which is the position of all time, the Church of all time, the truth of all time.
And yet, in the Vatican, there has been a condemnation of Archbishop Lefebvre's on tradition, saying that he has a misconception of tradition.
Well, that's right. Most notably came out in the Pope's document Ecclesia Dei, in which he condemned Archbishop Lefebvre immediately after the consecrations of the end of June in 1988. But this document, Ecclesia Dei, demonstrates exactly the liberalism of Rome. I mean, the Pope attempts to argue with the Archbishop. It's the first time, actually, that Rome has tried to argue with the Archbishop. By getting into the argument, Rome demonstrates that it doesn't know what it's talking about. It quotes, in order to demonstrate that the Archbishop makes a mistake about what Catholic tradition is, it quotes a highly slippery and ambiguous passage from Vatican II, which can be interpreted in two ways. It can be interpreted in an orthodox way, but if it's interpreted in the orthodox way, this passage supports Archbishop Lefebvre. On the other hand, if in order to support the Pope, this passage from Vatican II has to be taken in an unorthodox way. So, you know, the passage either approves the Archbishop, if you take it in its Catholic sense, or it approves the Pope, but then you have to take it in an un-Catholic sense. So in no way can the Pope lean upon this ambiguous passage in order to prove that the Archbishop is un-Catholic.
Well, the Vatican says that tradition is a living thing, and the Archbishop doesn't understand that.
That's it. And it quotes Vatican II. And of course, it's true that tradition is living, but to say that tradition is living is ambiguous. Now, what the Catholic meaning of tradition is living is that tradition continues right through the ages, and it's always there, and it's always embodied in living people, and it's always it always has vitality. But the modernist meaning of tradition is living means that just as living things change, so tradition has to change. Nothing living stays the same, and therefore tradition doesn't stay the same. And that's exactly what the Pope understands by a living tradition. And he considers, and the liberals in Rome consider, that the Archbishop is, for instance, what they would call fixist. In other words, he has an excessively fixed notion of what Catholic tradition is, but it's just not true. As you can demonstrate by studying what the Church did say and comparing it with what the Archbishop says now, and comparing it with what the Pope says now, or with what Rome says now. And it's clear that Rome is wrong. You take the text in hand and study it. But that Rome just doesn't understand. They're so far gone in liberalism that they have no idea what the Archbishop is about, and they have no grasp of what he means by tradition. Their minds are so fluid that their minds cannot fix on a notion like an unchanging truth.
Well, if the Archbishop doesn't understand that tradition is a living thing, then why did he go along with the changes of Pius XII to the Mass?
Yes, but the modernists' view of just how living tradition is go much farther than the Archbishop's view of how living tradition is. Of course, tradition is not fixed. Of course, tradition is not fixed in a corpse-like sense. It is something living. It's a truth which lives inside those who hold it in each age. And Pius XII made minor modifications to the Mass, and like Pius XI, like Pius X, to the Missal. And these minor modifications don't essentially break with Catholic truth. And therefore the Archbishop and all other Catholics, of course, they accept such changes. But the liberals want the Mass to be totally changed from start to finish, which is why we got Pope Paul VI, the new Mass, the Novus Ordo Missae. And that is such a denaturing of the Mass that the Mass is killed dead. I mean, if you take a plant and try and change it too much, you're going to drop it dead. I mean, if you take this plant and you uproot it and you say, well, now I want this plant to live without water and without its roots being in the soil, the plant will die, obviously. I mean, there's a limit to how much you can do to a living thing and still have it live.
Let's apply some common sense here. If one were to follow the liberal definition of tradition, tradition would be a completely meaningless term, because they mean it that you can make total flip-flops, make revolutionary changes, and we still be in line with tradition. So in a sense, that the fact that the Romans used that argument against the Archbishop shows that they, not the Archbishop, have a misunderstanding of tradition.
In fact, if you look at Ecclesia Dei close, if you look at its arguments, the arguments are false, yes. The essential argument in paragraph 4 is false. And so, but that's what you would expect. It's very grave that the leading churchmen should be in the grip of such grave error, but that's how it's been for quite a while now, and that's how it looks like being for quite a while yet to come. So we have to live with it.
Now, the Archbishop has said that Cardinal Ratzinger has liberal tendencies, and this is a statement which many conservative Catholics have a hard time accepting, because they consider Cardinal Ratzinger now to be the great white hope of the Church.
Well, on September the 8th in Switzerland, the Archbishop gave an address to this priest of the society that were gathered together for retreat at the seminary in Switzerland. And he quoted, in his speech, he quoted Cardinal Ratzinger amongst others. And he said that Cardinal Ratzinger had made at one point this remark about Vatican II, that it was a counter-syllabus. In other words, that it was opposed to the great list of errors made by the Catholic Pope Pius IX in the middle of the 19th century. And some people, says the Archbishop, criticized Cardinal Ratzinger for daring to say that Vatican II was opposed to the syllabus, was a counter-syllabus. That's a very grave thing to say. And so the Archbishop said, Cardinal Ratzinger has been looking for an explanation, and the Archbishop says that on June the 27th of 1990, a speech of Cardinal Ratzinger was published in which the Cardinal Ratzinger got his way out of this difficulty. The occasion was the Rome issuing a major document on theologians and the magisterium to explain the relationship between the theologians and the magisterium, because with all their liberalism, the theologians have been doing all kinds of things and getting almost out of control, and Rome no longer knows what to do with all these wild theologians, so they've had to try to keep them in line without coming down too heavy upon them, because to come down too heavy upon them contradicts liberalism. And so the document goes on page after page in order to try to keep the theologians in line without keeping them in line. So that's the contradiction in the document. And in the presentation of the document, what's more interesting is what Cardinal Ratzinger gives of his thinking. The Cardinal says, this document states, perhaps for the first time with this clarity, that there are decisions of the magisterium which cannot be the last word on the subject in question as such, but which represent an important stand taken on the problem. An important stand on the problem, and which are, above all, says Cardinal Ratzinger, an expression of the pastoral prudence, a kind of interim measure, unquote. And the Archbishop expresses his astonishment at decisions of the Holy See being turned into interim measures. The Cardinal Ratzinger goes on, quote, the kernel remains intact, but particular aspects influenced by the circumstances of the age may be in need of further rectification. In this connection, one may point out the statements of the popes of the last century on religious liberty, as also the anti-modernist decisions taken at the beginning of this century, and above all, the decisions of the Biblical Commission at that same time. Unquote. End of quote of Cardinal Ratzinger. This quote can certainly be found in the Osservatore Romano. That, as it stands there, is a translation. There may be one or two inaccuracies, but substantially that'll be what the Cardinal said. And the Archbishop comments, here are three decisive statements of the Magisterium, which may then be put aside, which can be changed. The position of the Cardinal is that these anti-modernist decisions rendered great service in their own day, but since they've served pastorally in their time, now they are nevertheless, because in their particular enactments or determinations, they're out of date. And so we turn over the page and forget about them. And so we can see how the Cardinal has got out of the accusation of going a bit far when he calls Vatican II an anti-syllabus, when he opposes the pontifical decisions and the magisterium of the past. He's found the way out. The kernel stays the same, but the particular aspects influenced by the circumstances of the age may stand in need of further rectification. And there the Cardinal's got it. He's out of his difficulty. And the Archbishop comments, it's frightening. It's unbelievable. How can any Catholic trust someone who thinks like that? What Cardinal Ratzinger in practice is doing, he is justifying the denial of Quanta Cura, the denial of Pascendi, the denial of the Biblical Commission's decisions. Now, there's no papal statements from the past are secure. They're all changeable.
So perhaps the answer to our dilemma then is that there's degrees of liberalism, and Cardinal Ratzinger is simply less liberal than the wild theologians on the left, but he still contains a degree of liberalism in his thinking.
Yes, that's right. But the difference between the two is...
Is it one of degree rather than of kind?
Yes. The difference between the two is much more unimportant than it is important. That is to say, the Cardinal Ratzinger, however well-meaning he is and however apparently conservative he is much closer to the extreme leftists than he is to Archbishop Lefebvre. And these conservatives who nevertheless stay with Rome, despite all their conservative appearances and despite all their goodwill and good meanings and good intentions and so on, they are in fact doing the work of the enemy. They are going along with the great liberal slide, and they're slipping away from the truth. And the only one who's standing up against that is Archbishop Lefebvre.
Okay, now let's move on to a new topic here. Let's return to the discussion of the changes in Eastern Europe, and I think that we've talked about the church is good here because the two is related. Because now there are some writers and church authorities who are saying that the present upheaval in Eastern Europe represents a fulfillment of Our Lady's promises made at Fatima, and that the consecration of Russia to her Immaculate Heart was already done several years ago, and that the changes that are occurring are a result of these.
Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Firstly, it's obvious that the consecration hasn't ever of Russia to the Immaculate Heart has not been done as Our Lady asked for it, because it has not been done in union with all the bishops of the world, and it has not been done with Russia explicitly mentioned as Our Lady asked. So, amongst all the consecrations that have been done, none of them is that consecration which Our Lady asked for at Fatima. Secondly, as I was saying earlier, I think, these changes are more apparent than real. That is to say that the communists are still firmly in control. They still have the police, they still have the guns, they still have the army. These things they've not let go of. And there is no question that the communists could shut those borders again just when they want, and they could clamp down again just how they like. Economically, the Eastern countries are a disaster, but as police states, they're a roaring success. And that police state is still there, and the communists could control it again just how they like. So the changes are more apparent than real. And as you were saying, and as many people say, the morality of these Eastern European countries has, if anything, gone down rather than up since their so-called liberation.
Which hardly amounts to a conversion.
Which certainly doesn't amount to a conversion. That's what my colleague was saying in Czechoslovakia. And therefore, from a spiritual point of view, there's neither the cause nor the effect. There's neither been the consecration, as Our Lady asked for it, nor has there been the conversion that was to flow from that consecration. There's just a number of soft churchmen who wish to pretend that the consecration has taken place, and an equal number of soft churchmen who wish to see in these political changes something really significant or spiritually favorable. But neither is the case.
So basically these churchmen then are simply being caught up in their own euphoria.
They are going along with a great current of, yes, everybody's nice, everybody's sweet, I'm okay, you're okay, Mikhail Gorbachev is okay, it's a lovely world and we're all going to be nice and happy together, and how nice it is we're all together and united and ring a ring of roses. It's just so much nonsense, the whole thing, from start to finish.
And wouldn't also her promise that her Immaculate Heart would triumph would imply that there'd be a restoration in the church? And the evidence would seem to be that the conditions are getting worse. I have all kinds of news reports in front of me which show that conditions in the church are getting worse. Like in the past year or two, they've closed something like 30 or 40 churches, both in the Diocese of Chicago and Detroit. I was in Ottawa 2 weeks ago, and we saw convents up for sale and a cathedral that had been converted into condominiums and so on. And again, one would think that if Our Lady's Immaculate Heart had triumphed, that the church would be undergoing a restoration, not being selling off all its properties.
Well, that's perfectly reasonable, but of course, unfortunately, these liberal churchmen, if they sell off 30 churches in a downtown, the downtown of a big city, they call that renewal. And if they close down all their seminaries, they call that progress. And if they see all the monasteries and convents disappearing, they call that a great advance from, the backward ages. I mean, their minds are so out of touch with reality that they're incapable of grasping that a great disaster is going on inside the church, and also, despite the appearances, in politics. The world is plunging downhill at an alarming speed, and at ever faster speed.
And lastly, Our Lady promised that there would be a period of peace, and yet it seems that in the Middle East and elsewhere, there's all kinds of conflicts that are raging.
Well, of course, I've been told that what we may see in the Middle East now is Mikhail Gorbachev come in as the peacemaker. That's possible. I don't know whether that's what will happen or not. And it's very possible, what is very possible, is that the globalists and the United Nations and the one worlders will come forward with some kind of solution. Then the Americans coming in to Saudi Arabia and the confrontation between the Americans and the Iraqis, that this artificial problem, in a sense artificial problem, will have an artificial solution, and a great credit will go to those who solve it. And already the prestige of the United Nations has gone up, and we've seen Bush in the with great smiles next to Gorbachev with great smiles, and this is all over the media. And the media, which were violently in opposition to the Reagan's invasion of Grenada, are now just as violently in favor of Bush's quasi-invasion of Saudi of the Middle East. I mean, how do you make sense of that? Well, the answer is that the globalists absolutely do not want an American America, and hence they're against America, against Reagan, but they do want a global America, and therefore for Bush. They're breaking down the national America, and they're replacing it with an international, as an America integrated into the international scheme of things.
And the liberals, who had been so opposed to America's involvement in countries like Vietnam or Angola or making an invasion of Grenada, are now urging a very hawkish mentality towards the problems in the Persian Gulf.
That's because the liberals want the one world government, and the American expedition to the Middle East is a great one world enterprise. And it's all the forerunning of the Antichrist. Now, the globalists may give us a kind of peace. They may come, as I say, Mikhail Gorbachev may now step forward and act as peacemaker, and we will get an appearance of peace. But it'll be nothing but an appearance, and it could easily break down. Scripture says that just when they're saying peace, 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 there's going to be the most terrible outbreak of war. And that's what we could have in our own day. I don't know.
Now let's relate the events in the Persian Gulf to the changes in Eastern Europe. You said they're pointing towards the creation of a one-world government, or at least a one-world system. Now, could it be maybe that part of the reason for the changes in Eastern Europe were to kind of prepare the way for this one-world system or one-world government, simply because communism in its old form was an obstacle to that, because the West simply would not have accepted that kind of a one-world system?
Yes, it's all diabolically planned. It's a very high intelligence. There's the intelligence of Satan, and his top human instruments is behind all of these things. And it does look, you know, as though the communist countries were sort of leveraged downwards. Well, Russia was firstly leveraged downwards by the communist revolution. And then the Second World War was very largely for the benefit of communism. The effect of the Second World War was a great advance of communism. There wasn't much other effect of the Second World War. A great advance of communism. But communism failed to get hold of Western Europe. Now, with another 40 years of corruption after the Second World War, it was being possible to drop the barriers and to mix the communist countries and the Western European countries. And the next step may be according to Dmitry Manuilsky, the invasion of the soft, synchronized East and West by the tough communist army, which is still there. The communist Russia is still arming at an alarming rate, gathering armaments, while the United States is reducing its armaments. The communists are still increasing their armaments. They have an incredible supply now, and store and reserve of weapons and men to use them. And when the moment comes, when the West has dropped its guard, thanks to this mixture, thanks to this friendship, thanks to this openness, thanks to Glasnost and so on, when the West has sufficiently dropped its guard, then the communists will come in. But since the same one-worlders are behind communism, then, you know, whichever way it turns, they reckon they're going to win. And so long as men continue to be turned away from God and distant from God, yes, the one-worlders, the enemies of God, are going to continue to reap the harvest. All of this is simply allowed by God as a punishment of these nations which should be God's nations, which have turned away from God, especially from the Catholic Church. And God is saying, all right, you don't want me, then this is what you'll have instead of me. You don't want me, then you'll want the devil. If you want the devil, then you'll get the devil. And we're getting the devil. Whether it's Western softness or communist toughness or Mikhail Gorbachev smiling or Mikhail Gorbachev with teeth of iron, in any case, it's always a punishment for our apostasy until we turn back to God, which doesn't look like happening for the moment.
Yes, and then the West could also face a renewed threat in addition to communism, even if, let's say, we'll give the benefit of the doubt to the people shouting the euphoria. Let's say that communism for now does not represent a threat immediately to the West. Let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. But the West could then be facing a renewed threat still from a resurgent and militant Islam. And it could be that Islam represents an even more dangerous enemy than just communism.
I don't know. I'd need to be informed on that one, but I don't know if the Mohammedans, the Arabs, they're mostly Arabs who are Islam, of course, Islam, they're mostly Arabs. I don't know if the Arabs have the technical competence.
But they're taking over Western Europe by stealth anyway. For example, the Muslims living in Western Europe have a higher birth rate than the Christians do. And of course, they recently opened a mosque in Rome, which would never have been permitted during the days of Richard the Lionheart and
all of this is quite simply insanity on the part of the West. But I still don't know. And of course, the population threat is from that point of view, grave. I mean, but the Lord God is rewarding the Mohammedans, wicked though they are in many ways, and the false religion though they have. At least they know how to have children, whereas your decadent, corrupt, and apostate West doesn't know how to have any children. And so those that have children are going to inherit the earth. That's very, very clear. But all things being equal, leaving aside those factors, I wonder if the Arabs have the technical competence to manufacture the sophisticated weapons. I still think that if the West got their faith back and were properly motivated and were Christian, I think they could beat the Arabs or beat the communists. They could beat anybody. But it depends upon them getting their faith back, and that they're not at the moment. They don't, as I say, they don't look like doing, and therefore they're going to get beaten.
Well, there is some evidence that if we had our faith back, we could easily give the Muslims more than a run for their money. Because I've heard sociologists say that in France there is only two groups that have a birth rate high enough to replace themselves. One is the Muslims. And one is the traditional Catholics.
It's certain that if those nations which were Christian yesteryear were to get back their Catholic faith, they have the same gifts with which they enlightened the world, with which they Christianized, with which they built Christian countries throughout all over the face of the world, in which they sent missionaries all over the world. Those nations would be back on top of the world. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, look at who was, when it comes to playing football. The four teams that got to the quarterfinals this time, Britain, France, Germany, and the Argentine, they're, you know. I mean, there's no reason why, I suppose, I mean, Mohammedan countries or, you know, pagan countries or communist countries could get into the finals of the World Cup, but, you know. I mean, those countries that... I mean, it's terrible to say that the Western countries now, you know, they're motivated by football and they're not motivated by the faith, but when those countries are motivated, they have the talents and the gifts to... I don't think the Mohammedans would represent a threat if the Christians had their act together, but if the Christians don't have their act together, they're going to be walked over by anybody.
So it's the same as with the communists. Their strength is essentially our weakness.
That's correct. It's because the Christian nations are weak that the communists are strong. It's because the Christian nations are weak that Mohammedans are invading the what used to be Christian countries.
Now, some of the optimists are saying that Christianity has been preserved in kind of a pristine form in Eastern Europe under the persecution of the communists, and now they are going to kind of lead a spiritual regeneration of Christianity now that the gates are down.
I don't think the evidence favors that view. It's true that inside communist Russia there's a strong underground church. Whether that church has the what it takes to Christianize other countries besides Russia, I don't know, but...
And we've kind of had an unrealistic view of the church in Eastern Europe as well. It's not as well preserved as many Westerners would like to believe.
Well, I think that's true. That's my information.
There's modernism there, to my knowledge.
In Poland, certainly. Yes. I was talking I was in Spain a few weeks ago again, and I was talking to someone there about a corruption of Spain. Spain, of course, had a great Catholic revival after the Civil War of 1936 to 1939, or what the Catholics there called the Crusade the anti-communist Crusade of 36 to 39. There was a great Catholic revival. It was a great Catholic country, but then in the 1960s, especially in the 1970s, thanks mainly to Opus Dei. The Catholic Spain was infiltrated and corrupted from within, and now Spain is as bad, if not getting worse, than many other countries. There's no exception to the broad rule. Men are mostly hurtling downhill. The great mass of men are hurtling downwards in a very dangerous way, and... who knows where it's going to end?
Is there much of a traditional movement in the Eastern Europe, to your knowledge?
Over in Switzerland a week or so ago, or 2 weeks ago, I saw a Polish magazine with an article on Archbishop Lefebvre. And with the present greater freedom of contact between East and West, one of the consequences will be of that, a greater ease for... ideas like those of the traditions may be to make way inside what used to be those communist countries. But whether the people generally want traditional ideas, that's a completely different question. I'm afraid they don't. I'm afraid what they want is Playboy and abortion.
Again, it'll only be a minority of people keeping the faith, as in the West.
That's it. I think the truth is that the more things change, the more they're the same. Let's say, wherever part of the world you go to, despite all the outward different appearances, deep down, it's the same essential situation. A small minority of souls seeking God, and a great majority seeking comfort and pleasure and the gifts of the devil.
And the results of that, then, is that we're very vulnerable to these enemies.
Yes, the West is extremely vulnerable, and in one shape, size, or form, or another, within the next 5-10 years, there's got to come, maybe even sooner, there's got to come some great crack. We can't live in this unstable and fragile world for very much longer, which is absolutely defying God.
And what do you think it will take in order that the West can successfully confront her enemies and pull herself out of this kind of decadence and corruption?
At the moment, I have to say, I think it would have to take a divine intervention. I think the Lord God has planted the traditional movement, if you like. It's a very small kernel of souls here, there, and everywhere, around whom other souls will be able to gather when the bombs start to fall, so to speak, and who are keeping the faith alive and keeping a hope alive and providing a center around which sanity and a reaction will be able to crystallize. But generally speaking, the great mass of men are today hurling themselves to perdition. That's how one has to judge.
And it will take some kind of suffering or chastisement to pull the majority out of it.
Yes, a divine intervention. God has got to intervene somehow. Or men have got to tear one another to pieces. Wars are terrible in many ways, but one effect they do have is to bring at least some men to their senses. And there may have to be a war, a divine intervention or a war in order to wake men up and make them realize what they're doing.
Okay, thank you, Your Excellency, for talking about the state of affairs in the world. And again, I hope our listeners have gained some insights from this discussion.